tribunal, after consideration of the evidence and the briefs filed, is now ready to pronounce its judgment.
After World War II, the German physicians who performed brutal medical experiments and mass murders were tried for war crimes in Nuremberg. It was called the Doctor's Trial, and the lead defendant was Hitler's personal physician, Karl Brandt.
Karl Brandt, Military Tribunal 1 has found and has judged you guilty of war crimes, crimes against humanity.
But Karl Brandt had once been an idealistic and talented young doctor. How could he go so wrong? I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, the doctors of Nazi Germany.
For your said crimes, on which you have been and now stand convicted, Military Tribunal 1 sentences you, Karl Brandt, to death by hanging, and may God have mercy upon your soul. The officer of the guard will remove.
In the late 19th century, German medical practices were considered to be the best in the world. But by the start of World War II, many German physicians were directly involved in the mass killings of the Holocaust. Dr. Theodor Rief is a scholar-in-residence at Christopher Newport University and co-founder of the Rief Center there, which supports the study of genocide, human rights, and conflict resolution. And I should caution you that some of the following conversation may not be suitable for children. What was the medical profession in Germany like before this period?
German medicine was considered to be the best in the world. Many American physicians and physicians from other countries went to Germany and Austria for specialty and advanced training. Some of the great hospitals were in Austria and in Germany. One of the most notable was the Allgemeine Krankenhaus in Vienna.
So where did you think we'd begin to see such a highly regarded German medical system sink so low as to become involved in the mass killings during the war?
I'd like to point out that most German physicians were not involved. It was a minority, but there were a significant number of physicians who did take part in some of the horrendous crimes and were complicit. The Nazis began a series of restrictions and regulations, for instance, that Jewish patients would not be covered by the health insurance program. And in fact, Jewish patients were not allowed to go to Aryan doctors, and then Jewish doctors were not allowed to treat Aryan patients. Then the Nazis started a program which was based on the premise that Germany was fighting for its economic survival and needed funds to rearm itself and do the other things that they wanted to do. And there were propaganda representations pointing out how much it cost to take care of disabled persons who were chronically ill and had little chance of recovery, or those who were mentally retarded and whose lives would be based in institutions. And the term Wurstlustzüge, worthless mouths to feed, was utilized.
And this was a period before the Nazis settled on extermination of Jews. This was for Aryans and others as well.
Yes, that's correct. And it's been estimated that between 80 and over 100,000 Aryans were put to death by medical personnel during the late 30s and early 40s by lethal injection and by gassing. They were placed into rooms that were ostensibly shower rooms, and lethal gases were introduced into the room. The acceptance of this was laid very subtly and very cleverly and very well by Dr. Joseph Goebbels, who was Minister of Propaganda, who was also in charge of education. And in the late 1930s, there were changes, for instance, in the textbooks in Nazi Germany, in the arithmetic books, the old problem of Hans has 50 marks, eggs cost a half a mark per dozen. How many eggs could a student buy with 50 marks was changed to it costs 2,000 to 3,000 marks to keep alive in a nursing home one elderly person who was no longer of any value to the Reich.
Oh, my God.
Question, how many young Aryan couples could be subsidized to have another child for the Führer and the glory of the Reich, for the amount it takes to keep alive in a nursing home one elderly, feeble person who was no longer of any use to society. And the euthanasia program was established. Adolf Hitler appointed one of his physicians, Dr. Karl Brandt, to head what was called the T4 program, which involved the extermination of defective human beings. Committees were set up in hospitals to make decisions as to which patients should be eliminated.
You write that systematically Hitler and his people gained control over one German profession after another. And of course, you're most interested in how the Nazis came to gain control over the medical profession. How was it done?
Well, it was largely done through incentives to the physicians. So there was an acquiescence because it benefited many of the German physicians. There were some who objected, but it was very difficult by that time to object on ethical grounds because the Nazis had such tight control over the profession and over society.
As the war progressed, what have we come to understand were among the atrocities committed by those doctors who did go along with these horrific experiments and actions against innocent civilians?
Well, there were a number. Some of the doctors did research on sterilizing both men and women. One of the methods was to use radiation to the ovaries of women. They would have the women sit down, not realizing that they were being subjected to radiation, which would destroy their ovaries. Many of these women developed severe burns in their skin because of the dosage that was used. Men were castrated and also subjected to X radiation. Other experiments were done by doctors in the concentration camps. These included injecting caustic substances into the uterus of women in the hope that it would cause scarring and prevent procreation. Some of them were done on prisoners at Ravensbrück concentration camp, which was a women's concentration camp north of Berlin. It was during the war, and many German aviators and Germans were being wounded and developed gangrene in their wounds. And experiments were done to try to learn how to treat gangrene using women at Ravensbrück as experimental guinea pigs. And wounds were made in their lower extremities. Dirt was rubbed into the wounds in the hope that it would cause infection, which would lead to gangrene. That didn't happen in a number of the women, so then they tried some other techniques because many of the wounds contained foreign debris, glass and shrapnel and pieces of wood. They started putting these substances into the wounds in the hope that would cause gangrene, and it caused a little, but not enough. And then they realized that one of the reasons that gangrene developed so quickly in the soldiers who were wounded was that their blood vessels, their arterial supply, had also been compromised. So then they started ligating the arteries to the lower extremities, and that produced, of course, necrosis or death of tissue, and that led to really good gangrene. And then the Germans started to try to treat the gangrene. Most or many of the women died. Others were mutilated horribly. A few survived and lived to testify in the 1946 war crimes trial, the second Nuremberg trial, called the case against the doctors, the medical case.
How extraordinary that there should be doctors singled out.
I suspect that one of the reasons was that the medical profession had always aspired to high ethical standards, and society expected that. Karl Brandt was the leading defendant. Karl Brandt is an interesting example of how a physician could be subverted by a government. He was a very bright young doctor who graduated in the 1930s, and his plans were originally to go to work with Dr. Albert Schweitzer, the Nobel Prize winner, in Lambourine, Africa, in Dr. Schweitzer's hospital. Hitler was so impressed with Brandt that he offered Brandt a position, and Hitler was very charming, and Brandt accepted it and decided not to go to Lambourine. And then Hitler gradually appointed him to various positions of higher importance until he was appointed, actually, the Gruppenführer SS and General Lieutenant of the Waffen-SS, as well as the Reich Commissioner for Sanitation and Health, which was analogous to the U.S. Surgeon General. A number of other German physicians were put on trial along with Karl Brandt. One of them, a very interesting fellow, was Dr. Karl Gebhardt. He was personal physician to Heinrich Himmler, the chief of the SS. He was involved in transplantation experiments. Some German aviators had lost their limbs after parachuting over the North Sea and elsewhere, and soldiers also had lost limbs. So Gebhardt was involved in research trying to transplant limbs to the injured amputees. And what was done was that limbs were disarticulated from concentration camp prisoners at Ravensbrück, from women. Their whole hindquarter was amputated and taken to the Hinrichshagen Hospital in Berlin, where attempts were made to transplant the limbs onto the aviators. Of course, none of them were successful. The patients whose limbs had been removed were killed by Dr. Herta Oberhäuser. She was the only woman defendant in the 1946 trial. Dr. Oberhäuser was convicted. She was released after serving, I think, about 15 or 20 years, and then went back to practice in northern Germany, where she was beloved by her patients. And the interesting thing about this is how, depending on the environment in which a person is, they can do either wonderful things by treating patients well, or if they're in a system that allows for barbarity, they can practice barbarity.
We've only had time to mention three of the 23 physicians who went on trial in 1946 in Nuremberg. What became of the others?
Well, a number of them were found guilty and hanged. Some were found guilty and sentenced to prison. Others were absolved. One of the other interesting persons who was convicted, Dr. Wolfram Sievers. At that time, Heinrich Himmler was interested in proving the inferiority of Jews. And one of the ways in which he did it was to search the concentration and death camps for deformed Jews, those who had congenital deformities. And they would be killed and skeletonized. And the skeletons showing the deformity would be sent to a medical museum. Himmler made an analogy to the museums in the United States that showed the history of the Native Americans, American Indians. And he planned to have a museum of the Jews, because hopefully they all would be exterminated and there would only be skeletons and remains left. And it would be an interesting study for future generations of Germans. Hundreds of concentration camp and death camp prisoners were executed and skeletonized, and their bodies sent to the medical museum at the University of Strasbourg. As the war was ending and the Allies were approaching Strasbourg, even though German transportation was needed for the war effort, Himmler requisitioned trains and trucks to transport the medical museum in Strasbourg back further to the east in Germany. Unfortunately, no trace of the remains have been found, but Himmler gave more value to transporting his museum specimens than he did for the war effort. Sievers was found guilty, and he was hanged as well.
You have for many decades specialized in medical ethics, and in particular medical ethics in the Holocaust. What gave rise to your interest in this subject?
Well, having lived through World War II and seen some of the results of the Nazi period, and then when I went to medical school and saw the research that was going on, most of it ethical and good and important research, but also seeing some unethical research, I began to look into the violations of ethics by the Nazi physicians and realized that there was a lesson to be learned. And I also found some disturbing analogies to policies and practices in the United States. In 1977, the Healthcare Financing Administration was established to control costs in Medicare and Medicaid. And I got hold of a confidential memorandum that was drafted for use in a budget meeting with the President of the United States, who was then President Carter. And it was a memorandum that contained some cost-saving initiatives. And it started out by pointing out that medical care costs in this country were very high at the time, but the recommendations were made that costs had to be reduced. And one of the proposals made by the Healthcare Financing Administrator was entitled Encourage Adoption of Living Wills. And it would have encouraged older persons to sign documents that would preclude life-saving medical care. And according to his proposal, quote, the cost savings from a nationwide push toward living wills is likely to be enormous. Over one-fifth of Medicare expenditures are for persons in their last year of life. Thus, in fiscal year 1978, $4.9 billion will be spent for such persons. And if just one quarter of those expenditures were avoided through adoption of living wills, the savings under Medicare alone would amount to $1.2 billion.
And how would the savings be accrued through the adoption of living wills, was it suggested?
Well, older persons would preclude medical care in their last year of life. Now, how the last year would be decided and who would be involved in that, it was later recommended that committees in hospitals be set up to decide which patients should receive life-sustaining medical care and on which termination of diagnostic and therapeutic activities could be undertaken. I believe that patients have a right to refuse medical care and that their wishes should be respected. But for the government to encourage life termination for cost savings, to me, is abhorrent.
Well, Dr. Reith, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
Dr. Theodore Reif is a scholar in residence at Christopher Newport University and co-founder of the Reif Center there, which supports the study of genocide, human rights, and conflict resolution. You're listening to With Good Reason.